It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, Discover Magazine's Gemma Tarlak breaks down a new study that rewrites the dinosaur family tree.
First, Governor Scott Walker is asking the federal government to let Wisconsin drug test applicants for state health care coverage.
The governor also said he doesn't want to use federal money available to provide health care for more Wisconsin residents. Instead, he's made proposals to move more single adults off state Badger Care Medicaid coverage and into the workforce.
Jason Stein joins us now. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back.
Thank you, Veronica. Good to be here.
Well, Jason, before we dig in, last Friday was a big day for Republicans in that they failed to get their own plan to repeal and replace Obamacare and get their new plan in place. That didn't happen. It didn't make it. So where does that leave health care in Wisconsin and Governor Walker's plans in particular?
Well, it's a great question. On Friday, the House Speaker, Paul Ryan of Janesville, said that Obamacare would be the law of the land for the foreseeable future. In the last couple of days, you're hearing again some Republicans and conservatives talking about bringing the law back. But I think for right now, the common wisdom is that it will remain law for at least some time forward. And if you look, you've seen some states like Kansas, my home state, passed an expansion of the Medicaid program, something that state had held off on doing. It may still be vetoed by the governor there, but some other fairly Republican states are taking another look at the Medicaid expansion in the light of the failure on Friday.
Well, and given that has been a sticking point between some, for instance, Democrats in Wisconsin and Governor Walker, that Wisconsin has not, like those states you just mentioned, Jason, taken that Medicaid expansion money. Is that going to change?
Right. It's a little like an old married couple where Democrats and Republicans in the state capitol here are always disagreeing and fighting over that issue. But I certainly don't think it's going to go away, in the light of Obamacare repeal failing. The governor and Republicans said, once President Trump had won the election, they said, we really look smart now that we never took the Medicaid expansion. And now, obviously, Democrats are going to try and argue that the opposite is true now that the Medicaid expansion remains law.
And Jason, in the meantime, as we wait to see what unfolds there, it sounds as though Governor Walker not moving, but he is asking for some changes in terms of the state's health care and the way it functions, and he's going to the federal government with that ask list. What's on it?
Right. So there's several things. One, he wants to be able to charge monthly premiums. And these are not the sort of premiums that people with employer coverage might expect, because we're talking about people who make less than $12,000 a year. These would be premiums that would range from a dollar to $10 a month for households. These are similar in some ways to what Indiana did under then-governor and now Vice President Mike Pence. And the Walker administration thinks that Trump's administration in D.C. is going to be likely to approve that. Other things include higher premiums if you use higher copays if you use the emergency room, doing a health risk assessment like you might have at a private employer, and submitting to drug testing to be part of the Medicaid program.
And it sounds as though a health risk assessment could be part of it, too.
Correct. So this would be the sort of thing that people in private employment often get, which is to, asking you questions about if you wear your seatbelt, if you smoke, if you, what your weight is, if you eat too many sweets, things like that, where they're trying to nudge you into making healthier choices that will make insuring you cheaper to do.
We're talking with Jason Stein right now, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at requests that Governor Walker has made to the federal government in an effort to get, he says, more people off Badger Care in Wisconsin and, as the governor puts it, into jobs. And Jason, what do we know about the price tag, possible price tag on these proposals?
Well, they're very expensive, and I should say that this is not something that would apply to your grandmother in a nursing home or to a child who, you know, has parents who are low income. I mean, these would be for single adults without children, these proposals. They would be costly. You know, the Walker administration expects that not to save money from these proposals, but actually to pay money. You know, it could be around $50 million a year when it's fully phased in. The Walker administration says that they're willing to make those payments because they think that it will be good for the state in the long run. It will make people either more likely to go out and get jobs or to be more effective in those jobs if they do end up getting them.
And Jason, you talked with an analyst from the state's Department of Children and Families. What is the sense there about how these proposals could affect people, some people in Wisconsin?
Sure. So I talked to someone with the Wisconsin Children and Council on Children and Families, which is a private group. And the argument that they made is that going out and trying to collect a dollar a month from people for health insurance, people that might only make $3,000 a year, is just not an efficient use of resources, that it would be really more cost-effective and less burdensome for people that may be leading chaotic lives to just write off those $12 and not worry about it.
And is there any chance that these proposals, if they were enacted, could go on to become a model for other public assistance programs here in Wisconsin?
That's certainly true. I mean, in that the governor is trying to apply drug testing and work requirements to unemployment insurance, to food stamps, to Medicaid. And I think Medicaid, in a lot of ways, will be the most challenging one for them, particularly with things like drug testing. And that's because, number one, it's never been allowed in the Medicaid program before nationwide, and also because I think healthcare can be a life or death matter, and so, you know, I think there's always going to be a critical look made at whether or not you should deny someone health coverage for any reason in the program, especially if it's a new reason. And in the case of drug testing, though, that what the Walker administration is going to argue is that they will make treatment available to people if they're willing to get it, and that they would still be able to receive the health coverage as long as they complied with those requirements.
And what are the next steps in this?
So the Walker administration has notified the state's tribes that it's making these changes. They will take public comment. They'll put out the full proposal on, I believe, April 19th. They'll take a month of public comment about that. They'll make any changes they make, and then they'll submit the final version to the Centers on Medicare and Medicaid Services. And there, the head of that agency, which helped to craft the Indiana proposal, will decide whether to approve Wisconsin. So that's one reason why the Walker administration has a lot of optimism that they'll get, if not all of this request, at least a big chunk of it.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, Veronica. Thank you.
That was Jason Stein, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us there to take a look at requests from Governor Scott Walker made to the federal government in an effort to move more people off Badger Care in Wisconsin.
Right now, we're looking at a new study published last week in the journal Nature that's rewritten the dinosaur family tree in a way that has many dino lovers reeling.
Gemma Tarlak has the details. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Oh, my gosh. So great to be with you guys.
And this is big news. I read your piece, and then I read Ed Wong in The Atlantic, who said he audibly gasped when he read the study. Why is this such a big deal, Gemma?
Well, this is a huge deal because since 1887, I mean, that's how far back the family tree we thought we knew goes. Since 1887, we have thought it's the first thing you learn in a dinosaur paleontology class. Dinosaurs are divided into two groups. And this new study has come in and said, yeah, they're still divided into two groups, but they're not divided the way we thought they were. They're divided in different ways, and dinosaurs that we once thought were really not even closely related to each other turn out to be like kissing cousins. So this is a huge shuffle up of, you know, I think it's kind of on par with realizing that dinosaurs are the ancestors of birds. You know, it's one of those things that just makes you stop and go, whoa.
Well, let's look at what may now be the old model, and it's kind of a hippie model, as I understand it, because it's based on dinosaur hips.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, Shakira sang, hips don't lie, but she was wrong.
But, yeah.
And basically,
well done, Gemma. I applaud this.
With these two groups of dinosaurs, these are the old school groups, again, around since 1887. You had one group called Saurischia, or lizard hips. And within the Saurischians, you had sauropods or sauropodomorphs. Those are, you know, Brontosaurus, the big old cows of the dinosaur era. You know, the long neck, long tail, huge guts for digesting all the delicious vegetation they were eating. And the other bunch in that group were called theropods. And those were the bitey things, velociraptors, T-Rex, kind of all the real famous villains of the dinosaur world, the toothy ones. So that's one, that's the old group A. And the old group B was called Ornithischia. And those were kind of the wacky dinosaurs that they were herbivores, all of them. And they were things like Stegosaurus and Triceratops. And you got into the duck-billed dinosaurs, which were things like Pachycephalosaurus. And I'm just going to stop right now reeling off species lists because I'm getting so excited. I'm literally bouncing up and down in my chair like a child right now. So anyway, these are your two dinosaur groups. And the division, which was made back in the late 19th century, was, again, by the hip structure. The Saurischians, or the lizard hips, had a pubis that pointed forward, and the Ornithischians, or the bird hips, which have no relation to bird whatsoever, they actually had a pubis that points backwards, as it happens to do in modern birds. So, you know, these, when you think about it, these very early paleontologists back in the late 19th century, they're looking at these strange bones, they're trying to make sense of them, and they really started dividing dinosaurs up by what they could see with the naked eye, or, you know, with a late 19th century microscope. So they were really, you know, they had no ability to crunch data like we do today to look at really fine variations from one sample to the next. So based on what they saw and could see easily, they made these two divisions. Now this Nature paper comes along, and they crunched the data. They looked at more than 450 characteristics across 74 different groups of both dinosaurs and dinosauromorphs, which are kind of not quite dinosaurs. They were evolving in that direction, but they don't fall in the dinosaur group. They looked at 450 characteristics, and they really crunched the data, looking at all different samples, all different specimens, finding those traits that, you know, the late 19th century paleontologists were not able to discern. And so they came up with these new groups. You're still there, right?
Still listening. Yeah, no, it's a lot to take in.
Again, bouncing up and down in my chair. So, okay, so the two new groups, we've still got Saurischia. They're still around. But now that includes only the sauropods and the sauropodomorphs. So only Brontosaurus and Titanosaurus and all the other long-necked, long-tailed, big-bellied herbivores. That's what Saurischia is now. Meanwhile, we've done away with Ornithischia. It's gone. The bird-hip dinosaurs are gone. Instead, they're proposing this new group called Ornithoscelata. And basically, in this group, you've still got the old Ornithischians. You've got your Stegosaurus and your Pachycephalosaurus and your Hadrosaurus. But now you've also got the theropods. You've got T-Rex and Velociraptor and all the bipedal carnivores that once we thought they were like way, way far away on the evolutionary family tree from Ornithischia, and now they're all in the same boat. So this is mind-blowing, and I'm just going to sit here and bounce up and down in my chair for a while.
So what does this do if you're a paleontologist? Do you have to burn all your old research and start from scratch? How does this change things going forward?
Well, I think a lot of people are still in a state of shock. And I think, you know, quite frankly, probably if you walked up to a 7-year-old and you said, hey, there's this new dinosaur group, they would be like, oh, grown-ups lie all the time. Like, we're all just kind of, what? But I think what's going to happen now, and I love that the authors of the paper, they admit this. They're like, look, we know this is crazy, and we want more research. We want to find more evidence in the fossil record. We want to crunch more data. We want other scientists to look at our data and really pick it apart. But if this is proven, if we now have to reorganize the dinosaur family tree, you literally have to start from scratch. You have to start from the very earliest evolution of dinosaurs and change the textbooks, rewrite everything. One other interesting thing about this paper, and there's tons of interesting stuff in it, is that they also push back when we think dinosaurs evolved. Right now, the language is around 230 million years ago, a little bit before 230 million years ago. This paper, looking at the different traits and how long they would have taken to evolve, they're pushing it way back to 247 million years ago. So when people rewrite the textbooks, they're going to have to rewrite that part too.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, looking at new research that shakes up the dinosaur family tree. Gemma, I read that at some point there was a question that, hey, maybe some things we call dinosaurs now, Brontosaurus, I think might have been one of them, depending on how we slice and dice our definitions, might be taken out of the dinosaur group altogether. That didn't happen, it sounds like, though.
No. I mean, pretty much what we classify as dinosaurs are still dinosaurs. One of the kind of minor things about the paper, one of the minor details, is talking about the Hererosauridae. And they were very, very early dinosaurs. I've seen some papers in the past group them into dinosauromorphs, which were the super early, not quite dinosaurs animals. But this paper, as well as others I've seen, does say, yeah, these were legitimate dinosaurs. So that may be where some of the issues rise. But, you know, I'm glad you brought up Brontosaurus, because that was kind of another bombshell a couple years ago, where for a long time, Brontosaurus was kind of this, he was the Pluto of the dinosaur world, and that, you know, he wasn't a real species. And it was just something kind of a mistake, or maybe, you know, maybe a little bit of a fabrication or a misunderstanding in the early 20th century. Then again, this paleontologist comes out and really crunches the data, looks at thousands of different data points, something you could not have done late 19th, early 20th century, and just looking at those data points, crunching the data, finding the very minor traits, and being able to rebuild and relook at where Brontosaurus fits in, came to the conclusion that, yeah, Brontosaurus, it's a real dinosaur. It's a legitimate separate species. It's not just a juvenile Apatosaurus. So I think what's really interesting about paleontology is that more and more it's moving into the hard sciences, where, you know, 50 years ago it was all about finding a bone, looking at the bone, comparing the bone to other dinosaurs, living animals, and trying to figure it out that way. And now, I mean, the way they are able to collect data points and process them and just build incredible ways of looking at information we didn't even have a couple decades ago, the picture is becoming more and more clear.
And it sounds like this research could have some bearing on feathers on dinosaurs, because there were feathered dinosaurs, but it sounds like, you know, we might know more about when feathers appeared or disappeared with dinosaurs.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the interesting things about feathers is that pretty much almost all of the feathers around have been found on theropods. And if theropods were in the old dinosaur group A, and they've been taken out of that dinosaur group A and put in this new Ornithosaurida dinosaur group, with some of these other dinosaurs that the few times we've found feathers on something other than theropods, it has been on these other dinosaurs, like some of the duck-billed dinosaurs, for example. And now that they're in a group together, it does raise the question, well, what else had feathers within that group? But right now they're not saying that particular having feathers or not having feathers was not one of the characteristics they really looked at. In this new paper, they were looking at things like, you know, the shape of the ridge in one of the digit bones, for example. I mean, it's pretty, very, you know, granular kind of stuff, or the shape of the orbital window, for example. They were looking at very specific detail. So feathers were still, you know, still a couple questions out on that, but it does raise some really interesting questions.
As I understand it, this new research gets into some issues of where, when it comes to dinosaurs and where they evolved, and that might shake things up too.
Yeah, that was, you know, as I was reading this paper, literally I was sitting in my office going, what? What? Oh, you've got to be kidding me. Because, you know, for the longest time, the most primitive dinosaurs, including Herrerasaurus, which I mentioned some people don't think is quite a dinosaur, these dinosaurs were found basically in South America, a little bit in Eastern Africa, but these are Southern Hemisphere animals. And now, again, because of their data crunching, this new study is saying, actually, we think the cradle of dinosaurs may have been in the Northern Hemisphere. So that's another kind of bomb they dropped into the field. But, you know, a lot more research is needed to figure out if they're on the ball or not.
So, Gemma, you mentioned the rewriting of textbooks, et cetera, et cetera. But there's one paper, you know, one collection of data points. So does that mean that we're going to have to really wait, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years until we know whether this is the new prevailing wisdom about dinosaurs?
Well, you know, with any huge shift in the field, and for example, the whole idea of dinosaurs descending from dinosaurs being the ancestors of birds. I'm sorry, I'm so excited, I can't even talk straight. But the whole idea of birds descending from dinosaurs, that was actually first proposed several decades before it was really accepted by the field. So this may be that moment where someone has looked at the data in a new way and made new connections, and now we're going to go through you know, years and years of people picking apart the research as they should and trying to prove them wrong. I mean, that's how science advances. You come up with an idea, you test it, and then you and other people try to pick it apart and prove yourself wrong. So it may take decades, but just the way the field is advancing in terms of our ability to process information, whether it be how we look at a fossil, you know, the new techniques that they use to look at fossils, or whether it be the new algorithms we can build to process data, it all comes down to, you know, how fast can we figure this out? And I bet we're going to see a much faster picking apart and testing of this hypothesis to figure out if it's legitimate or if we need to keep those old textbooks around for a little while.
And very briefly, Gemma, given the state of the art and research, are we going to keep seeing bombshells like this in the dinosaur world?
I don't know that there are that many more bombshells to drop on this level. But, you know, we'll see. There's always the next fossil that's sitting there in the ground waiting to be found. And there's always the next new idea that a paleontologist sitting at their computer has and decides to test. So maybe.
We'll leave it there, Gemma. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak with Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joined us to look at a new study that rewrites the dinosaur family tree. Find a link to her blog post at the Central Time Facebook page. Athletics are a big part of Wisconsin culture on college campuses and beyond. As universities around the country struggle with the problem of sexual assault, some advocacy groups say it's time to focus on the role of coaches in helping solve the problem.
While students and student athletes may cycle through universities every 4 years, coaches tend to stick around longer and provide a focal point for what can feel like a family.
It may be that the team mentality comes with benefits and sometimes risks. According to a 2016 study, student athletes scored lower on a test measuring an understanding of sexual consent than the general college populations.
Thomas Velton Irwin joins us now. He is a reporter at the Daily Cardinal, UW-Madison student newspaper. Thomas, thank you so much for coming up to the studio today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Brian O'Connor is with us as well. He's director of public education campaigns and programs at Futures Without Violence. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi.
And Thomas, we're going to start with you. The Daily Cardinal just did an action project issue about sexual assault, and you wrote a piece about coaches and their role, their potential roles in preventing sexual assault. And you start by describing what happened with the Minnesota Golden Gophers last December. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so what had happened was there was a group of student athletes on the Minnesota football team that had allegedly committed a gang rape in early September, I think it was, after their season opener. And a couple of players were suspended. I think eventually between 6 and 9 or something like that were suspended. And almost immediately after this decision to suspend these players was announced, the rest of the players announced that they were going to be boycotting all football-related activities, including the big bowl game that they had coming up. I think it was the Holiday Bowl in San Diego. And there was a lot of outcry about this for good reason, because there was effectively no evidence that these students had not committed any crimes. And just a few days after this boycott was announced, there was a leaked document from the university's report into the allegations, and it was, you know, incredibly in depth. I think it was 80 pages long, and it was pretty damning. And there was, you know, massive public outcry at these players' decision to boycott. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting was the head coach of the football team, Tracy Clays, made public statements, I think it was on Twitter, that he was really proud of his players for this decision and that they were standing up for what they believe in. And so that's where the coaches come into this, is that, you know, somebody needed to tell these players that what had happened, if without enough evidence to say that nothing had happened, it was a bad decision to side with the people that were being accused of a crime.
And you also interviewed some experts for this piece, Thomas, including Jessica Luther, author of the book Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football, and the Politics of Rape. And what did she have to say about that dynamic that you were getting at there about sports teams as it relates to sexual assault?
Yeah, so Jessica is really adamant about this idea that with players cycling in so often, you know, a lot of players don't even stay for the full 4 years. It's less true in football than it is in basketball, but it's still true that they're often staying 3 years. So that there's so much turnover from year to year that it needs to be the coaches that are making this change. And we talked about Tracy Clays a lot because he's a prime example of coaches not making change.
And Brian, let's bring you in here. What do you see as both the benefits and the risks of the culture that can develop within and around a sports team, and also go on to inform the culture on a university campus, for instance?
Sure. No, and thank you so much for your piece. I will say that unfortunately, this is not unique to the Gophers. It's not unique to Wisconsin. And that we have seen, I don't want to say necessarily an increase in sexual assault cases on college campuses. However, what we have seen is certainly a spotlight on the importance of investigating these cases. And so, you know, actually, in some ways, you could see this as a positive, that more victims feel comfortable coming forward and being able to tell their story, oftentimes feeling maybe perhaps that they feel safer in order to share what's going on. And so, you know, I think that too is somewhat of a silver lining, frankly, to some of this. When it comes to specifically around athletics, I think it's also important for us to keep in mind that oftentimes, you know, these young men and women are the popular kids, you know, the popular young adults on campus, and they also really set the tone of the culture of the campus in many ways. And so, you know, I think that there's actually a really great opportunity here to build their leadership. This is a leadership moment in the midst of really some bad stuff.
And Brian, among other things that your organization is doing is zeroing in on the coaches in particular as a focal point to try to educate and to teach athletes about healthy relationships, bystander behavior, things like that. Why coaches? Why are you focusing there?
Yes, you're referring to a program that we have called Coaching Boys into Men. And actually, it is a program that is implemented, is running in Wisconsin as well, and all around the country. As we were talking about just earlier, that coaches have a very unique relationship with their athletes. Coaching Boys and Men in particular focuses mostly in on high school programs, but we've also worked on college campuses as well as then aging it down in middle schools as well. Coaches, you know, hey, athletes are looking for playing time, so they listen to what their coaches are telling them what to do. And as I mentioned, not only do they have a unique relationship and opportunity, but sometimes, and I definitely think on the campus environment, hey, you know, you spend more time with your teammates and with your coaches than you do probably with anybody else.
We're talking with Thomas Felton Irwin right now, reporter at the Daily Cardinal, UW-Madison student newspaper. Also with us is Brian O'Connor, director in public education of public education campaigns and programs at Futures Without Violence. And we're talking about the efforts there to focus on coaches when it comes to sexual assault prevention. And Thomas, you wrote about a UW group called We're Better Than That. Can you tell us about them and what they do?
So You Better Than That is technically not exclusively athletics. The subtitle of that group is Men Against Sexual Assault. So what they try to do is bring men into this conversation, which has historically, a lot of the onus for talking about sexual assault has been put on women. So their goal is to bring men into it. They do have several branches of their group, and one of those branches is athletics. And there are a lot of athletes involved, even outside of just the athletic sphere. So Grace Wald, who's on the UW swim team, she's the vice president. And what they try to do, they do stuff like host workshops for athletes, and just give them a space to talk about sexual assault and talk about what can be done to prevent sexual assault. And like Coaching Boys Into Men does, talk about effective bystander behavior and how to talk to other athletes outside of that workshop.
And Brian, I want to ask you about Coaching Boys Into Men and what happens in that program. You're training coaches, I imagine, in ways to have conversations. What are some of the ways that you're promoting in talking about sexual assault prevention and teaching about healthy relationships?
Sure. Thank you. The program is pretty straightforward. It is one where the coach facilitates a conversation on a different topic each week, just 15 minutes a week with his athletes. This program in particular is for male coaches with all male teams. There is a complementary program as well for female athletes, so I think it's important to get that out there. But Coaching Boys Into Men most specifically really is about how we, and I was mentioning too, how we kind of really around the leveraging the popularity, the social capital, I guess you could say, of athletes on campus, and particularly male athletes. I mean, they do hold, unique capital and influence on the campus and really setting the tone and the culture and the climate. So with that, the coach is then really motivated, inspired, hopefully, to have these conversations anywhere from, personal responsibility, talking about disrespectful behavior towards women and girls, bragging about sexual reputation, various topics each week where, there's a little introduction, but then the coach asks just some discussion questions to the athletes about what they think, and really using different scenarios and that whether you're bringing in a headline or you're talking about a specific incident that might have happened in the community that everybody might know about, but you're really being proactive about having these conversations and asking where your athletes' heads are at. How are they feeling about this? What might be some of the distinct pressures that they might be feeling as athletes on campus? What might they be exposed to that might be different than, say, other students as well? And so having those conversations ahead of time before something bad happens also, too, is really important. And it's even more important when something does happen, because unfortunately, as I was saying, it's not unique to Wisconsin. It's happening all around the country. And so just because we don't talk about it doesn't mean it's not happening. Coaches really have an opportunity. And some ways, in my view, and in Futures Without Violence, the organization that I work for, our view is that we have a responsibility to our young men, particularly our young men and women, to talk about these issues.
Brian O'Connor is with us now, Director of Public Education Campaigns and Programs at Futures Without Violence. Also with us in studio is Thomas Felton Irwin, reporter at the Daily Cardinal, that's UW-Madison student newspaper. As we talk about the effort to focus on coaches when it comes to sexual assault prevention.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea, training coaches to take the lead to get them talking about sexual assault prevention? What role do you think athletes and coaches can play in creating a safe climate and preventing sexual assault at the college level, high school, even middle school level? If you're a coach or athlete at a high school or college level, do you talk about these issues with your team? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the effort to look more at coaches when it comes to sexual assault prevention. Thomas Felton Irwin is with us, reporter at the Daily Cardinal, and Brian O'Connor, director of public education campaigns and programs at Futures Without Violence.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about efforts to train coaches to talk about sexual assault prevention with their teams? What role do you think athletes and coaches could play in creating safer climates on campuses, especially when it comes to sexual assault? Have you dealt with this on your own team as an athlete or a coach? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Brian, we have some calls ready for you, but I want to ask you first before we dive in there, what do the coaches think about this? I mean, I can see that there could be the attitude that I'm here to create a team and teach a sport and to win, and this is outside my purview. Are you seeing coaches that are receptive?
Yeah, no, it's a great point, because coaches are coaches, right? They're not social workers or nurses or law enforcement. And so we want coaches to be coaches. You're bringing up a really great point in that coaches can't do it alone. We have found that coaches are very receptive to this, kind of like what I was alluding to just before the break, of that they do see their responsibility and the opportunity in helping to build, you know, strong, healthy young men. They also, frankly, see being able to help their athletes navigate sometimes some really really difficult situations with their relationships or what they're exposed to on a Friday night at a party where there's some drinking going on, etc. When they're able to provide some of that support and guidance as the coach, they actually have been able to build a stronger team and greater team cohesiveness as well. And so we hear that from coaches all the time.
And Thomas, I want to ask you, as far as I know, you didn't interview any UW coaches per se, but do you have a sense about how receptive athletes are and administrators in general here at UW-Madison?
Yeah, Grace talked a good amount about how she felt the culture had improved or was better than many other universities across the U.S. So she did seem like when they host these workshops, student-athletes feel really comfortable then leaving those spaces and talking with other student-athletes and other students in general, because, like Brian mentioned, athletes have an absurd amount of social capital, especially on this campus and campuses where athletics are such a big deal. So they can then, once they understand how to do these things and how to talk about things like sexual assault, they can then lead those conversations among their peers and fellow students at UW, aside from just those that are on their team.
And we're talking right now about a new focus on coaches when it comes to sexual assault prevention and why that could be changing things. And I want to ask you, Brian, are you looking at all your organization? We're talking about this program that focuses on coaches in particular. Your organization is bigger than that. Are there other spheres you want to look at that might be similar to coaches, where there is maybe a leader who helps create culture that you want to target for this kind of education?
Yes. So I think that, you know, kind of what I was saying, when coaches can't do it alone, I do want to just go back real quick around the campus community, right? And so coaches also want to ensure that when they are trying to build their strong team, and, you know, also nutrition is important and the conditioning is important and running your plays and how this is best integrated into practice, there's only a limited amount of time you have with your athletes. And so they definitely don't want to see this as an add-on. And so it's always trying to make the case and showing how there are how this is important in helping to build a strong team. And where's the buy-in on campus come from? So making sure that administrators are on board, making sure that any healthcare providers are also on board too. You know, as far as when I say healthcare providers, kind of thinking about you know, the team trainers, for example. Everybody, there's a whole constellation of individuals that are important in helping to build the health and well-being of the athletes and, frankly, of the student body overall on campus, that are also really important to kind of come into this.
And Thomas, let's ask you, your paper just did this this action issue. It was largely entirely devoted to the issue of sexual assaults on college campuses. Do you get the sense that that conversation is opening up?
Sure. Yeah, I think you see this with a lot of issues recently that, you know, people, especially students like my age, are becoming more willing to talk about these things. And there's a big movement towards being comfortable talking about them and having spaces where it's okay to say things. And it's okay for people who don't know what they're talking about to talk about things. And because that's the only way to learn. So while I do think there is a sense that people are becoming more open to it, that's still just, a step on the ladder and there's a long way to go.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Matt joining us in Madison. Matt, hi.
Hello. Am I on the air?
Yeah. What did you want to share?
I'm going to take you off. I like this idea. I think it's very good. I think that as a society, we should expand upon this thought. And it's difficult to say where the work is best done. For myself, I've allowed my own spirituality to lead me to just uncomplicate life in the sense that I can preach to people about being positive and being loving and kind. And I'll preach that to anybody that will give me an ear, right? And beyond that, life is just too complicated for me. Now, in this specific example, this is a great effort, but I think that the more and more that we apply this type of responsibility to people, not just coaches, not just teachers, not just parents, not just community leaders, but everybody. And if we take it upon ourselves, eventually it has to get better. You can't argue with that love and positivity and kindness. You just can't argue with it.
Matt, thank you for that call. And Brian, Matt saying we need to take it to the public at large, not just coaches. Do you think that the message is getting out some more about different places to talk about, different venues? And also, as you were saying, are people feeling comfortable maybe reporting a sexual assault as well? Are you seeing the ship sort of turning on this?
Sure, I am. I mean, I think that it just having, I mean, even the former vice president's It's On Us campaign was one that was shining a pretty bright spotlight on the issue overall and focusing in on college campus. I think, you know, it's from a prevention standpoint, I think if we start early, I appreciate the caller's sentiment too around it's, you know, we were kind of alluding to that earlier in some of the conversation that it's about everybody wrapping ourselves around each other and around young people too, to help them build and healthy relationships and be those examples as well for them to do that. So absolutely. I mean, this conversation is focused in on coaches and that they have a unique relationship and therefore opportunity to influence their athletes in a way that could be really impactful and one that we've seen.
And Thomas, you were talking earlier about the social capital of coaches and athletes as well. Are there other instances, you know, parallel to that, that you see where there are leaders on campus that might have different social capital than athletes but still be looked to as leaders that could be another focal point down the road?
Sure, yeah. I think the obvious answer here is professors and teaching assistants and people that have, you know, positions of leadership outside of the realm of athletics on campus. There's just, in every relationship, there's almost always a power dynamic between two people, whether it's between just one on one or it's one in five or one in 100. There's always someone who has a higher position of power. And I think it does have to be on that person to do this education so that the people that they are following them can then go on and become that leader for someone else. Because if you think about it like a coach and then a player and then like a player's kid, for example, the coach teaches the player and the player teaches their kid. There's always a hierarchy like that. And I think it needs to come from the top down.
And Brian, as we wrap up, any words to coaches or athletes who might be listening? Got about 20 seconds here.
I just want to thank you for this work and, you know, recognizing, like I said, unfortunately, if we don't talk about it, it doesn't mean it's not happening, right? And so I can tell you and attest to the fact that it helps build stronger teams, stronger athletes, which then obviously make for stronger teams.
Well, thank you for joining us, Brian. Thanks to you. And Thomas, so glad you could join us as well.
Yeah, thank you.
We were talking there with Thomas Valton Irwin, reporter at the Daily Cardinal, UW-Madison student newspaper, and Brian O'Connor from Futures Without Violence. And they both joined us to talk about the role that coaches can play, also athletes, in preventing sexual violence.
Some shocking news for these spider lovers and spider haters among us. According to a new study in the journal The Science of Nature, the world's spiders consume somewhere between 400 million and 800 million tons of prey in any given year.
Big numbers there. To put it all in perspective, according to the Washington Post, the total biomass of all adult humans on Earth is estimated to be 287 million tons. Kind of see where we're going with this.
So spiders could eat, they won't, but they could eat all the adult humans on planet Earth and still be hungry.
And there's more. A survey of North Carolina homes turned up spiders in 100% of those homes. So that means if you think you live in a house without spiders, you're probably kidding yourself.
And some people are creeped out by this. Let's look at the bright side. Spiders, again, not really human eaters, I think, for the most part. They're eating things like mosquitoes and bugs and other stuff that we don't want around. So we should feel like we have powerful friends out there
and
in the natural world.
Some of them are furry, which makes them kind of cute.
Yeah, I don't necessarily buy that, but more power to you if you do. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.